Welcome to Native Yoga Toddcast. So happy you are here. My goal with this channel is to bring inspirational speakers to the mic in the field of yoga, massage, body work, and beyond. Follow us at Native Yoga and check us out at nativeyogacenter.com. All right, let's begin. Welcome to Native Yoga Toddcast. I'm so delighted to bring Sharon Berkovich onto the channel today. She lives in Berlin, Germany. She's an art instructor, a professional artist, and an Ashtanga yoga teacher. She speaks about how she views the world through the lens of an artist and a yogini. And you can find her on her website, which is choreographyonpaper.com. You can find her on Instagram. Definitely do go look up Sharon because her art is just so powerful and incredible. Her Instagram handle is at SharonHB. The links are in the description below. I also want to give a huge shout out to my most recent subscriber who offered support, financial support for this show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You know who you are. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Much appreciated. All right, let's go ahead and get started here with Sharon because she has so many beautiful, amazing, and insightful things to say. I just can't wait for you to hear this. So let's begin. I feel like an incredible opportunity here to speak with Sharon Berkovich. And Sharon, how are you doing today?
Pretty good, actually, today.
Yeah.
Today's pretty good.
Thank you so much for joining me. I believe you're in Berlin, Germany. Is that correct?
That's very true.
I've never been to Berlin. I recently had a student come in who had been traveling through Europe, and I said, if you were to move from USA to Europe, and you've been all over Europe, where would you move to? And she said, without a doubt, Berlin. She just was so enamored with Berlin. And I asked her, well, like, why? And she said, well, like, her take on it, and maybe you'll disagree and you can enlighten me, but her take on it was that, you could still afford to live there, that it had, like, this cool artist vibe, kind of maybe the way Manhattan did before it became so impossible to be able to be an artist and afford living in Manhattan, New York. And then she said, like, the culture element and just, like, everything that's going on, she was just really enamored with Berlin. Can you tell me your feelings and thoughts about where you live?
Okay, so I've moved here 5 years ago, and Berlin was not new to me because I have family here, so I've visited Berlin a bunch of times before moving. Actually, yoga got me here. Maybe we will touch that as we continue. And I think I was attracted to this place because a specific yoga teacher was very curious about the way that he was teaching. But I find Berlin to be just, I don't know, there's this sense of space here that I come from Israel. So that's where I'm originally from. And I lived in Tel Aviv for 7 years before coming here. And I love Tel Aviv. I didn't move because I hate it. Well, no way. I don't know. Like the sidewalks are big, you know, wide.
Yeah.
Nature is available. Of course, it's comfortable financially to live here. I mean, it's very affordable to live in Berlin still.
Nice.
And I think you can find anything you want and need in Berlin. I mean, I find Berlin to be very peaceful and quiet for me. But I know that if I was the other way around and I was looking for some action and, the party scene that also exists here and raising family is also, you know, so it's like anyone can find their place in Berlin. And it's still very comfortable and affordable. So I highly recommend it.
That's cool. I hope to be able to visit one day for sure. I found you on Instagram. I searched like yoga and art And when I found your profile, I am enamored with your artwork. It's so incredible. I think you're an amazing artist. And then when I saw that you also are an Ashtanga yoga practitioner and teacher, I was so excited to reach out to you. And so with that being said, thank you so much for being willing to join me here. And I guess I want to start, if you don't mind me asking some questions about your art life, but can you tell me when you started to connect with creating art? Was it from a very young age, or is it something that you got more into like later on in life?
Well, I don't have any real memories from being a baby or a toddler. But rumor has it that I held a pencil when I was 1 year old, and I guess I never stopped. So drawing was always a big passion of mine. Actually, people are a big passion of mine, and how people's emotions and personalities are being represented by their bodies and their faces, their physical expression or their facial expressions. So I was always attracted to it. I was a very, I guess, quiet and shy girl. And I was just staring at people all the time. I was just looking. I was so intrigued by people's behavior and appearance. And I am till this very day, actually. So I've been drawing people and I guess getting better at it as I went. And yoga came officially into my life a little bit over 10 years ago. That's maybe 10 and a half years.
Nice. And so like, what did you start to create pieces of artwork, like say middle school, that your teachers said, wow, you have some skill? Or where was the point that you feel like maybe you received a little bit of acknowledgement that gave you a push to feel like this is something you're going to pursue?
Well, I come from a family of, let's say, people who can draw pretty well. So, but not, they don't, like no one actually worked at it. So my mom draws and does really beautiful craft work. And so she always promoted, like encouraged us. We are three sisters. So she encouraged us to create and to draw. And I have an older sister, and so she was always better than me, so I always wanted to catch up.
Yeah.
So that encouraged me. But I was, you know, yes, teachers said that I draw lovely. And I think one thing that I remember very clearly is that I hated learning how to draw. I didn't want to learn how to draw, and so I didn't really I think drawing for me is the only area in my life where I don't let anyone tell me what to do. There's like this, the only place where I don't research how to do things almost at all. I think the only thing I was really interested in learning how to do is to oil paint, because I felt like, okay, this is something that I need some explanation. What am I doing with this? And so I did study it around the age of 25, so about 16 years ago. And yeah, so, but encouraged to actually do it as a profession, that was never there.
Mm. You
know? Yeah. It was always like, choose something practical to do.
Yeah. That makes,
yes, I guess. Yeah, I guess until this day, there is a little place in me that struggles with this. I want to be, you know, I want to create art full time almost, but there is something that feels very, very insecure with really going for it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I understand that. That makes perfect sense. Are you, so I see that you teach yoga, so I know that you probably earn some from your teaching. Are you selling art? Are you able to earn some money from the art you create?
Yes, but my main, I guess, income and profession and business is actually teaching.
Oh.
Or teaching people how to draw.
Teaching art. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. That makes sense. You're so good. I figure you have to be on some level teaching. I probably would need to pull it up and read it because it's a little bit of a more lengthy video that you posted on Instagram where you were giving a lecture. And there's a picture, I think you might have drawn, of someone. It looks like they're like almost opening their abdomen up. And you're speaking about vulnerability and your ability to open yourself up, which I thought was really cool. Like to see the way that you write with your blog and then back it up with the visual art part is so creative. Can you tell me what you're teaching, what you get out of teaching and or what inspires you in teaching?
Okay. So I think what you mentioned was actually, I have a lot of things now running through my head. So that fragment of a lecture that you saw, unfortunately, the whole lecture was not filmed. It was just a little piece of it.
Yeah.
But that was the first time that I stood on a podium and actually talked about the connection between art and yoga.
Mm.
I was invited to, God, I don't remember the full name of the place.
That's okay.
I think
it's
an,
okay.
Art, an art institute in Stuttgart by a yogi friend that actually lectures there. And so I was talking about my creative process. And I had the opportunity of really talk about art and yoga or creativity and yoga and how they combine and kind of, I guess, help each other to grow together and separately in my life. And the picture behind that, the one that you talk about, is actually, I lived in the U.S. when I was 22, not that far from where you are. I lived in Hilton Head Island.
Oh, cool. Yeah. South Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah. And back then, it was the first time I had an official like sketchbook. I bought a sketchbook and I was drawing every day. And it's an old one. And I think it's something I never showed anyone. And I was standing there and showing that to an audience of art students, and that was a very, I guess, a very vulnerable place for me to be. Mm. And you asked about teaching art, I guess that was the question, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I like your answer. I'll let you finish which way you're going to go. But I'm curious, how, like, as an art teacher, what inspires you? Is it the experience of seeing your students explore, and do you coach them along? Like the way that you said that you prefer not anybody to really tell you how to do art. Like the art is the one thing that you maybe don't seek outside opinion about while you're creating it. When you're teaching, do you try to refrain from offering your own sort of opinion, or how do you go about teaching art? How do you get an art student to like have their eyes open up a little bit more and get deeper into it?
So I think I started to share drawing or how to draw with people after I finished my bachelor's degree. And I think I was around 28 probably. And I think I didn't have the confidence until that point to actually come to people and show them how to do it, because I was doing it myself, but I never asked how it is done.
Mm.
And then at the last years of my bachelor's degree, when I studied or learned how to paint with oil colors, I also kind of learned new techniques I saw how my teacher was teaching other people how to sketch, how to work with pencil and charcoal. And I picked up, you know, like his techniques. And of course, in time, I enriched them and they became my own, you know, like it's a mixture. But what I learned or what I saw as I was starting to teach other people how to draw is are the difficulties and the insecurities that that people experience when they see something and they want to draw it. When you look at something and you want to describe it on paper, which is just to create something out of nothing kind of experience.
Yeah.
And what I know till this day, I mean, I think in my first years, I was more leaning into giving people those tools of that will bring them the confidence to actually go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And nowadays I work with people more. I do like, I work on from both sides, or I choose two angles to combine them. One is being more intuitive, like, and to see how you feel with it and to trust, you know, to trust yourself that you're able to do it. And on the other hand, to give those, okay, you do need a little bit of a, you know, those little techniques that will help you do it. So I combine the two, but I know that, I mean, I'm like a living proof that you can, if you stay there long enough, you can do it without anything, you know, there's, you need nothing.
Wow.
Need time and patience and this passion, you know, this like inner, I want to say calling, but it's not really, I don't think it's an inner calling. It's just this, this curiosity, this like endless curiosity of like, I find this interesting.
That's so cool, Shiran. That's so fascinating. I'm curious, do you believe that artistic skill, you're born with it, or something that anybody can cultivate it if they're willing to put the time and patience in the way that you're speaking about?
I think that the second one.
Yeah, you do. That's good. Yes. I mean, it sounds like that's the approach that you took. Like, look, I want to learn how to do this without anybody telling me and showing me. I want to figure it out on my own. But you did say that you came from a family of artistic individuals, which makes me think, I guess maybe if it's not something that's a born skill, that then the nurture element of being in an environment where people around you are creating probably has to help.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's not the deciding factor, it sounds like, based on what you're saying.
I think that, I mean, the people that are creative is that my mom knows how to draw pretty well. And my sisters also, but neither one of them actually continued, you know, with in my direction of hyper-realistic drawing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's, of course, it gave me the freedom to do that, or to see, you know, it's something that can be done and appreciated. But as I said, I was not promoted to see it as something, you know, for life, like this is what you're going to do. I was always, if not verbally, but it was also verbal, encouraged to choose something that I can actually make a living out of. I do want to say that when I was teaching others how to draw for about 3 years, and then came yoga, and it was just, I always saw the similarities, how similar the realizations that you have with yoga, and I'm talking about yoga philosophy and drawing, just, you know. And then I just realized, I mean, it does work like that for me, that a lot of the concepts in yoga philosophy are, you know, they're just like, they're out there, and you can sense them maybe, but drawing can give you this more tangible experience of what yoga teaches about.
Wow.
Yeah. About the illusion of reality. About separation and dualism, and like, you know, it's just like all those concepts are available to you when you start to use your eyes to see the world around you. And I think I'm, you know, I have, I'm human. I have my hardships in life. But the fact that I draw, that I look at things and I draw them, has given so much to my life even before yoga. And yoga just enhanced that But this ability to experience everything as if it is the first time I see it. And I have it with people, and I have it with nature. And I think I remember even, I used to say it, I remember that I noticed it with, you know, it was a while back, but one of my serious long-term relationships. I remember I used to say to, and we agreed on it, me and my partner, that it has this feeling of like every time that we see each other, it's the first time that we see each other. So wow. It's this excitement that stayed for 7 years. And then when I hear about people getting bored of relationships, I'm like, how come? It's like every time it's like the first time, you know, nothing can be boring when you really experience everything for the first time. So I think this is a gift that drawing brought into my life.
That's a really good example. I was going to ask how you saw that connection, but that makes perfect sense. If you're looking at something like I'm about to draw this object, that it would cause you to have to study it on such an intense level. So that's so interesting that you can make the parallel with relationships, that ability to like come into the moment and not, maybe not even like that you see your partner and you're necessarily, I think I'm going to draw my partner, but maybe just seeing the moment, so to speak, in between. So that's really cool. How did, so you're an Ashtanga yoga practitioner and teacher, was that the first type of yoga that you were introduced to, or what was the doorway to the Ashtanga world?
I tried a few types of yoga before. I think I want to say something about the previous part about experience things as new, that it's not necessarily because I want to draw them, but I think when you look at things, you realize that things are never the same. And every time you're going to look at something again, or you're going to look at it longer, or you're going to take like an inch, like a little step to the right or to the left, you're going to discover something completely new. And things don't look the same all the time. They always change. And this is what drawing brings. This ability to understand, to accept change, I think, and to appreciate.
So, I mean, I'll be really honest with you, Sharon. I think I can draw stick figures, but that's about it. And so I have very low self-esteem with my artistic ability. And so as a person who I don't think I can draw, but you're getting me really intrigued. You're making me feel like if I just practiced a little, I could probably maybe actually turn a corner to feel like I can draw. So what kind of advice could you give me just in this, like moving forward? Like when you were saying I was imagining an apple, like when you said you can just move a little bit. And if I was envisioning an apple, and then if I just like come around the side, I'm going to maybe see a little bump on the side of the apple, or maybe the way the light is shining on the apple, but then the process of trying to like convey that on paper with a pencil, what do? I just do the best I can and just try and just see what happens and don't judge it. I mean, what is your advice here?
I think maybe the first step is to, since you practice yoga and you probably sit for meditation, is to allow yourself to see things for the first time. Because when you come to draw an apple or anything else, without knowing subconsciously, you have a relationship with that object or subject. So you already have a picture of an apple in your mind before you even go and describe it on paper. So I think the first step is this allowing new information to come, to kind of put aside what you think you know about the apple and actually look at it as it is and understand the relationship that you have with it. You know, am I looking above it? Am I below? Is it right in front of me? Am I from this side? Like, understand that. And then understanding that, well, that is something that will be easier to do if we actually were in a class, but that every line you want to draw does not represent separation, but actually the relationship between what you draw and everything that's around it. So let's say if you place an apple in front of a white wall, everywhere that this white wall is going to meet that apple or whatever color it is, right, you will draw a line. But if you understand that you actually describe where this two shapes and different colors meet, then you are actually creating a relationship. You're describing a relationship between this shape and that shape. And you're not just trying to divide things from each other. Mm. So I think these two things will be the tips that I will give.
That is so interesting. Gosh, I've never even thought about this stuff. Diving into the mind of an artist. This is cool.
I think it's the mind of a yogi artist.
The mind of a yogi artist. I know when you made the mention of, well, one of the words you used earlier was the illusion of reality. So then if we just like go a little bit into, if you were to study, say, the classic one that we all come across is Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, what do you glean from Yoga Sutras in relation to the nature of reality and or its counterpoint, the illusion of a reality?
I think I cannot come up with one specific sutra, but... And maybe we will get also to this topic
as we keep going.
But I've distanced myself from yoga philosophy a little bit in the recent year or two.
How come?
Because I went through a process of recovering from eating disorders. And I found that I used a lot of the yoga philosophy also as an escape and not just a way of seeing things. So wow. It was important for me to take a step back and listen to my own voice, or to find my own voice and inner intelligence that is standing aside of the unspoken ideals that some of the scriptures describe, you know.
Well said. That's a great point. Yeah. Okay. However, you're coming back into it. No.
Yes. But I do want to say, I mean, I have given a few, a little bit of yoga philosophy lectures in this past year and connected things to art. So the way I see the illusion of reality is, first of all, this sense of separations is one of them, I think. You know, there's me and there's them, you know, and of course there's all the talks about in yoga and yoga sutras about the there's the ocean, you know, and the wave and what we think we are.
The picture that you drew of the wave, because I think your wave picture. Yeah. And I think you started talking, well, you made a little bit of allusion to what you said in that post about, am I the wave or the ocean, or am I separate from the ocean as a wave? But the drawing of the wave, at first I thought that has to be a photograph of it, like a black and white photograph. It's so realistic. I surf, so I love wave pictures and drawings and any sort of wave imagery. So when I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, you're so skilled. But I didn't want to interrupt you because you were going down a good thought. I threw you off, but I wanted to throw out there that your wave picture. So everybody listening, please go check out Shiran's Instagram, and I have the link below. It's at Shiran HB, I believe. Did I get that right?
Yeah,
cool. Sorry, but let me let you finish your thought about the illusion of reality in a wave and an ocean.
So that feeling of separation, right? Of and also the mind controlling everything. So even what I said before about you have a distinct image of an apple when you want to draw an apple, right? That's already Yoga Sutras. It's you see you project through your mind into reality. And you don't really see things for what they really are. We don't. And so I think that part was very strong for me from the Yoga Sutras, even though I cannot point right now at a specific sutra at the moment. But yeah, that illusion of reality being something very constructed, very materialistic, while, and I think now it's not Yoga Sutras, but also that that interconnectedness, you know, of everything, how everything affects everything. And when you start to look at things, you will understand that nothing can exist on its own. And you are a part of everything, because it's just, it doesn't stand alone. If the wall, okay, let's say if everything behind me was not there, maybe you couldn't even see me.
Yeah.
And
so I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So everything has to be where it is in order to exist the way that you see it. And I also want to say that when you really look at things, when you draw them, not just look, and the more you look and look and look, you realize that everything is so abstract. You are the one who creates the lines, and you are the one who creates the vision between things, because it's easier for us, I believe, as people to have this separation. And I think it's also very natural, because we experience things as a separate body. But there is that dimension that when you go deeper, whether it's through your eyesight or deeper within, that you feel that, or you see that things are just, you know,
That's a great explanation.
Thank you. I wasn't sure that I actually put it into words.
It's very hard. Yeah.
Into words, I find.
Yeah, I know these concepts are, but I like the fact that you're using art as a way to explain some of these difficult philosophical notions that potentially Patanjali and or Yoga Sutras and or all yoga philosophy attempts to do. That's a really great medium. I want to try to also get clear on, you mentioned you practiced some yoga before you started Ashtanga, but was there a moment where then you took an Ashtanga class and you went, okay, this is what I want to do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I my first yoga class was with my father when I was, I don't know, 8 or 9 or less years old, at a community center back in my hometown, and I only met it again somewhere in my late 20s, I think, I think I went to a few classes at university. And it was always nice. It was always relaxing. It was, you know, it was nice. And I always said, like, oh, I would like to do it again. But it never really happened. And a friend recommended me to try Mysore style. Like, she didn't even say, like, Ashtanga. She just said Mysore style. It's a bit, it's like, I think now looking back, it's a bit funny. I always was afraid to go into Ashtanga specifically, not even Mysore, because my my boyfriend's ex at the time was an Ashtanga teacher. And I was, you know, a little bit jealous. I didn't want to, you know, just feel that she's much better than me and compare myself and all the insecurities of being like a younger person. But then at some point I was like, okay, I'm going to give it a try. So I started with regular Ashtanga classes, which I liked. But I didn't like him that much, but I felt that Ashtanga had something that I liked. And then I tried Mysore. The first Mysore class, actually, I can't say that I liked it, but it was too far from my house from where I lived. So I was like, okay, I want to try Mysore, but I want to be closer to where I live. And I found one. And then when I went into that class, that was it.
Where was that? Where was that?
It was 2013 in Tel Aviv, the south of Tel Aviv. The studio still exists. I think the location is different. The teacher, thank God, still exists.
Who's the teacher?
Her name is Keren Or Kitches. I hope I say her last name correctly. And she's a wonderful, just wonderful being. And I got into that class and I couldn't believe it. I could just be me. I can practice on my own pace. I can progress gradually. We can modify it for my tight hamstring. I don't know. It was just, I was breathing, you know, I had this such a sense of relief. And I started to go every day, or almost every day. It was very hard for me physically at the beginning, I got to say, for years. I have not a very, my background. I had a lot of illness in my past. I had ulcerative colitis. I had a serious flare up for almost 10 years. It was, moving up and down, but I had a lot of serious flare ups and then medium and serious and medium. So my body was not strong. So I think for the first almost 4 years of the practice, it was always going back and forth. And but definitely never left it since my foot stepped into that Mysore room. I had other teachers since, lovely ones, but I do owe my, first crash falling in love to that. To Studio Naim and Keren Or. That was just, she just caught my heart there.
I love hearing that. I had a similar first Mysore experience too. Incredible. I'm curious then, at what point, you said you've been with this Shangha practice maybe 10 years, you said. So at what point did you decide to teach Ashtanga yoga? Did you have somebody come up to you and say, can you please cover a class for me? You're doing really great. I know you know it. You don't have to do anything. Just come in and teach, or just observe. Or did you do a training, or did you go to Mysore? What was your pathway toward becoming a yoga teacher?
I wasn't planning on teaching. I do have a background with being a fitness instructor and Pilates instructor and things like that, but it was always a side job thing, art, and teaching art history and teaching drawing was my main thing. But I really wasn't planning on teaching yoga, but at the same time, I was just interested. I always wanted to know, to learn more. So in my first years, because I was very physically unwell, I combined a lot of philosophy studies into my yoga practice, because there were times that physically I just couldn't really practice asana. So I went to Shivananda centers and retreats with my teacher, no more my friend, but a sweet Swami, Kashi Muktananda, really sweet, sweet, wonderful guy. So I studied philosophy, but I always wanted to learn more. And I also wanted to learn more about asana. And of course, you can do it in the Mysore room, but I felt like if I now go on a journey, and in Israel, I think it started back then already. It's not, it's not the short dense yoga trainings. It's a 4 year or 2 semesters, let's call it.
Yeah.
So I decided to do one of those just to learn more. I didn't want to be a teacher at that point. And I ended up doing 2 years.
Wow.
I did primary series for the first years in that year, and then I did the second series in the second year. And the teaching came because on the second year, in order to get the certificate, which I did, even going to the second year was do I really want it? Do I want second series? It was all I didn't know. But I went out going for it. And to get the certificate, I had to volunteer. So
nice.
To teach, to give classes.
That gave you the push to break
and
in.
And that's how it started.
Yeah.
I gave community classes, and also the thing that was even more precious and important for me is that I contacted a nonprofit organization that helped women from difficult backgrounds. And we gathered a group, and the studio I was working in gave me a room at a specific time. And then I just had a group of women, and it wasn't like Ashtanga yoga, you know. We were doing very soft, you know, simple classes, a lot of breathing. And at that point I was like, you know what? I can do this.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool.
I can teach this, and then came some subs, you know.
Yeah.
But my actual intense teaching period was in Berlin. Started in Berlin.
Nice.
About five years ago, a bit less.
Are you currently doing both Mysore style and leg classes, or are you sticking just with the Mysore, vice versa?
At the moment, I'm in between things. I was working at a solely Mysore place for 3.5 years. And then for a year and a little bit, another solely Mysore place. But I added a place that also I give, you know, a lead primary class. And we started a little bit of Mysore lately, the last few months.
Yep.
So I give only one class that is like an instructed class, which I really like because it's a mix. I do a mix of primary and second modified. So I feel like it's a playful kind of thing.
Yep.
But Mysore is what I truly believe in. You know, this is what I believe in.
Yeah.
This is what I practice. And then it's hard to do things that are different. If I see someone that I feel, you know, that needs that supporting hand or word, I want to be able to go to them. And I feel that in a group setting of an instructed class, I cannot do it. Mm. And it's hard.
I hear you. Yeah. Have you ever taught a yoga and art workshop or class where you bring people in, have them practice, and then in some capacity engage in art?
It's something I really want to do. I did a little beginner's experiment about a month ago at a nice retreat center in Israel. So we started to build it up. But it's something I would really love to do, but I haven't done that yet.
That's cool. How, if in your imagination and or your thoughts are like thinking like, how could you incorporate it, or how, cause you definitely can go deep, like philosophically. So I'm wondering like drawing other people in down dog, or maybe they do a sun salutation and then you have them draw. I don't know. How could you build the connection between creating art and deepening the yoga practice experience and or vice versa?
I think the main connection between drawing and practicing asana, or not just asana, meditation, is observation. So that is like the thing that links everything. So it's mainly getting together in order to I don't know if improve is the word, but
good point.
Yeah, it's not to improve your skill, but yeah, it's just maybe to deepen your observation in, but also learning how to deepen as you look out, because I think yoga takes you inwards and drawing takes you inwards through looking at the outside world. And since,
that's,
and you know what,
that's
in asana,
yeah,
asana practice is almost the same, because one of the rational explanations of asana practice is that, you know, there's like the eight limbs, right? And four of them are things that you can physically work with, and the other four are being developed on their own pace. So we work on the body because we experience things on the physical level. And it makes sense, you know, it's through the body, we can develop the ability to go deeper and to become more aware and to quiet the mind and everything. So I think with drawing, it's the same. We our visual sense is just so strong and so connected to all the information that we get and process and experience. So to learn how to see things a bit differently, to communicate more with that sense of sight can be something that brings a lot of stillness to the mind and an opportunity to get to know ourselves a little bit better. And I feel that what yoga brought to my drawing is enhancing the sense that I am not separate from everything. And it got me as a person who's, I think in my nature, I don't know, I guess a little bit more introverted. I love people. And at the same time, you know, I need my time. I need my quiet time. But it got me to a place that is just more open. And instead of being in my own skin, analyzing, you know, like every little thing to the smallest detail and suffering within, it just opened me up to say, like, you know what? I don't want to feel that alone with this. I want to communicate with other people in more ways. And it got me, and it grew my art because I started to work with people more and getting more, you know, and doing projects with people and being inspired by other people's story and stories and find myself in, you know, like together with other people. And I think that eventually, even though I went through a very strong period of being angry at myself and the method, but it really led me to,
yes, I can relate.
to open up to really recover from my eating disorders. That was something, I mean, when that came, it brought a lot up, and I'm kind of curious to hear about your being angry at the method period, but it got me to this like real faith crisis.
Oh my gosh.
Kind of situation.
Yeah.
You know, that I am, I think for at least 6 months, but I'm just like, you know, I'm finding my way out of it back to this like strength and faith, but it was really hard. I haven't stopped practicing during that time. Physically, almost yes, because if you have body image issues and eating disorders, then one of the important things that I felt naturally compelled to do was to see how can I practice without that place, you know, that uses the practice to maybe look a certain way or to it's not even look a certain way. It's to have this criteria of like, if I do this every day, I'm a good person. This sets my value. So I had to communicate with that place. And since then, I'm just I'm a much softer practitioner.
Oh my gosh, Sharon. Yeah. Maybe this is something we all have to go through at some point. Like a universal yoga practitioner, dark night of the soul experience that I would agree 100%. I think you're doing a great job of communicating the intricacy of some of these elements that we're coming up with the yoga practice. But yeah, the faith part, I can agree with you 100%. Maybe there was something that happened cosmically that caused a lot of us to have a similar challenge of faith of the practice and or of yoga in general. So, or maybe it's pure coincidence that what you're saying, I feel like I just been going through as well, but turning a corner and coming out the other side going, oh, phew, That was heavy. Let's just relax a little bit here. Just take it easy. Just have some fun.
One of the things that I did, I don't know if I did it in order to, but I used it as an experience that really, I think it started to bring me up a little bit or out, not up, just out. I gave a lecture, I don't know if a lecture, but just a talk about the meaning of the opening and the closing mantras of the Ashtanga Yoga practice. And I think that what was really hard for me as a human being practicing yoga is to truly accept my human side. I think what I was really leaning into is using yoga to, you know, to become higher than this human self. And through recovery is actually what I'm learning to do, is to accept it. And I think that already in the opening mantra, you have this finding peace within dualism, just right there in the first sentence, because you have, you know, I bow in front of the teacher's two lotus feet. So you have 2 feet. It already talks to you about dualism. And it shows you the sweetness of life, but it's because you're able to see the two and you don't exclude one. You learn to...
Ooh. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Both of them. And they say lotus. And then I'm like, sometimes I think it's so corny, but still, you know, that lotus that is growing in this like dirty water, and you cannot not have that roots in the dirty water. You cannot be that beautiful flower that you see on the outside if you have no connection to that bottom. And it's not dirty. You know, why do we even call it dirty? It's just two things that work together. They seem different. But I think, so what I'm learning to see is that I cannot detach myself from this being. And this is for me the process of recovery and actually living a more peaceful life, because I think maybe the poison of immortality, right? Or that poison that we are talking about is that constant inner fight, you know, that I personally say that I was much more involved with. I cannot say that. I don't think it will ever go away. It's like the best thing about forgetting who you are is to remember, you know. But yeah, it's just this poison, I think, is that self-criticism of like, you know, like what you are as a human being. And it's not even your maybe, I don't know, eating habits, smoking habits, dating habits, whatever habits that we have. Those are not the dark stuff. The dark stuff are the things that we find that are underneath those behaviors that we just find very hard to accept. Maybe it's our need for love that we criticize, you know, that we feel that, I don't know, our little insecurities, our basic needs that we want to say, maybe I can just make this pain go away using whatever.
Ooh. So much, so much goodness in all of that. Where do I even touch upon? That is amazing. In relation to, I definitely have not thought about the 2 feet. That's cool. And as versus like the 1 versus 2 feet in the opening mantra, Vande Guru Nam Charanaravinde. I'm going to bow to the lotus feet of the guru. And you're seeing feet, saying feet is plural as opposed to like this singular. And so this idea of trying to separate ourselves from the stuff that's really horrible and difficult. I love that you brought up the lotus and the murky water. You have to have one to have the other. So that element of acceptance, you know, it did make me think, I'm guessing you've heard of the really well-known Ashtanga yoga teacher, Tim Miller.
Yes.
And he's my teacher. And one time he was here in when Patabi Joyce was coming to Isla Mirada down in the Florida Keys. We drove down there to practice and Tim showed up. And so post one of the practices, Tim, we had the chance to take Tim out to breakfast. And so this was at the point where I was looking at my teacher as like, he must be holier than and bigger than and more advanced than and all the extra things that we hope that someone that we put on a pedestal will be. So I figured he's probably like a breatharian or something. Like he probably doesn't even eat food because he's just living off of air. So I said, Tim, where do you want to go eat at? Because we're in the Keys and I mean, we're probably going to get like fried food. I mean, there's like not a lot of good healthy options. And he said, oh, let's just go anywhere. He's like, I'll eat anything. He's like, I'm not a, I'm going to make sure I get this right. I'm not a yogi that disguises their eating disorder as spiritual discipline. And I went, wow, that's intense. Because I was always, because there is an element with like, maybe if we read, say, Hatha Yoga Pradipika and or some of these other texts that expound these really hardcore aesthetic practices that might, you know, say something like you should only drink milk or you should subsist off, a yogi can live off of, you know, just this and that and not much else. And that maybe if I do want to not eat much because of my own body dysmorphia issues, that then I can read into these classic texts and say, oh, yoga is actually telling me I need to have an eating disorder. So I love that you're bringing all this up. What have you found in relation to, you kind of already answered this question because I feel like you answered in just this recovery mode that you're speaking of in terms of being able to accept the sides of you, me be able to accept the side of myself that I'm just not real happy with, or I think I should separate from. But is all this sounding similar, different, ringing true? Anything you can say after I mentioned all that?
Get back to it in a second. I do want to say that the lotus feet, sorry, I'm throwing us back.
No, there, please.
Richard Freeman did write about the two lotus feet. He wrote something different, but I think this is the first time he made me think about the two. You know, that was like, I think that the way he continues it is different, but then I was like, you know, it just threw me to that place of dualism.
Mm.
That way. So I do want to say that because it is something that stemmed out of something that I read.
Yeah.
For the eating disorders, I don't know if I got you completely right. But I do think that you mentioned your teacher and that putting someone on a pedestal. So I think there's always this search for a method. Is like something that we all have with everything. And it does, I think it connects to this, I think one of the explanations of what perfectionism is, I put it in one of my lectures, is Brené Brown. And she speaks about perfectionism is this belief that if you will do 1, 2, 3, 4, you will not suffer anymore. This is just my way of putting it. Don't quote
yeah.
the moment.
I liked it. It rhymed though. It rhymed, so it worked.
We all look for that. So we search for that method. It's like, I think I'm going to bring something that is maybe, I don't know, I'm Israeli, so I can be a little bit rude. But people that drink coffee in order to go to the bathroom in the morning, you found a method that works for you and you repeat it because you think that if you will not do this, you will suffer, you know?
Yeah.
Or do this, you don't suffer. So it's like those, even this is a method. So Ashtanga is an Ashtanga method, you know, and it lives in the same dualistic world that it talks about. So with the beauty of it comes the other side of the coin of searching, yearning for something that will fix us, you know, that will make things better always. And then I can say that I came to many types of I can say I want to say diets, but it's like, you know, not a weight loss diet, just a, you know, because of my autoimmune disease. So I tried everything. And it was just unbelievable to see how my eating disorder was playing in each and every one of them. Mm. So it's like the big, like the sign, like the bright sign was like, I'm trying to get healthy, but with a sick mind, you know, so how can you really do that?
Yeah.
So I think also with the Ashtanga method or just every other practices, it's really, I think maybe it's Ramdas was talking about the beauty of methods. He said a really good method will catch you, you know, it will make you like defend your life, you know, like you will defend it with your life, you know, you will just, it has to be like the best thing ever. And he said that if you're lucky enough, you will wake up and you will see that what that method brought to you was always there. And then you can use it, but you don't have the same illusion of, you know, and maybe not the same obsessiveness towards it, that this is something that really fixes you. So I think for me right now, Ashtanga, it's still, you know, I still question things. I'm not like, I live in recovery from the main eating disorder that was consuming my life and health, which was bulimia. But I still have, you know, like eating habits that I think that are, I mean, I still will use food to manage the way I feel. So I'm not fully recovered. But I think some of it, you know, lands on the normal spectrum of emotional eating. But I think it was just really important for me to address practicing not as something that sets my value, that says that if I'm doing this, I'm a good person. If I don't, to let go a little bit of that fear that, wow, if I don't practice for 2 days, I'm gonna lose my strength. And even if I would write a post about it and declare that I'm totally fine with it, like inside I'll be like, you know, I can say, by the way, like pretty proudly that in the last weeks I've been subbing for a wonderful teacher that had to go to the U.S. I'm taking care of her shala, which while she's gone, and it's a big effort for me. You know, I wake up at 4. I haven't done that for a while. I need to be there at like 6:15 in the morning. I teach till 9. And then the studio has other classes, so I cannot do my practice after. And then the day goes on, and I need to go to sleep early. And, you know, I have my drawing business and everything. So I'm like, honestly, I cannot even, you know, I'm not even trying to shove in a practice, you know?
Yes.
And I'm totally fine with it. I can practice if my body allows it on my days off. I stretch, I do stretches, and I'm talking about asana practice. I mean, I sit for meditation, I have this, and it's okay. I can get weaker, weaker, like quote unquote weaker. I can lose some of this strength that I usually have or flexibility. I'm okay, you know.
Doesn't that feel good, Sharon?
Yes. And it's funny because still, if I say it to another fellow, you know, yoga friend, they will be like laughing, you know, like as if they're kidding, but they will say, oh, you're a bad yogi. And I'm like, yeah. <You know? laughs> But there's still this perception of like, we can say out loud that we feel good about not practicing. Mm. I don't think I feel good about not practicing. I feel good about allowing myself not to practice and to do this wholeheartedly and like give myself a pass of like, okay, it's working like crazy for me to get back to waking up so early in the morning.
Oh man.
And, and working with people, because I haven't done that, I think, for at least a year, maybe a year and a half.
I
haven't woke up before and got to teach so early. and it's people and energy, you know, and you're there to support others. And what I learned, part of the things that I learned in recovery is that if my tank is empty, I have nothing to give.
Yes.
I can't go on empty. And the practice doesn't, like the asana practice doesn't necessarily fill me up all the time. It might fill up my ego that I did it, you know, but I might be even more tired and, you know, and just exhausted.
Yeah.
And,
it sounds like you're maturing, Sharon.
It's about time. No, I'm actually, I think I really enjoy, I want to say on the same note, I really enjoy growing up.
You
know, I really enjoy getting older. I love birthdays. I celebrate every age I get to. And I really love the fact that I chose to come to this world, even though, you know, it's not easy. But
yes.
I celebrated 40. It was like, yes, I made it.
Well, where are you open to sharing where you are now? What age are you now?
I'm 41.
Nice.
And half.
It's so funny. I turned 50 this month, and I started thinking I got to multiply 50 times 365 and see how many days. Because it's a funny thing, like, oh, how many years old are we? And then it's like a pretty nice, easy number to remember. But if I knew how many thousands of days old I am, like, that's an interesting for me, just like to shift that perspective. Like, okay, I got another day. Let's do another day versus another year, just to kind of change the perspective of the time shift. Cause I don't know. I know when my mom passed a year and a half ago, and for me, that I think was a big part of my transition from losing faith to regaining faith and with my practice, with God, with life, with everything. And so, yeah, when it comes back around, it feels good because it's like a little bit of maturity or just like, you know, you just turn a corner and you're just like, oh my God, I don't have to freak out about these things anymore. It's okay. You know, so I'm with you. I love hearing your story, Sharon. I think, well, A, you bring a ton of depth to the conversation. I love that your perspective on art, the way that you helped me to see that the way I look at things and how maybe I perceive them in my mind and the way that I could potentially express them, be it through the medium of art and or maybe communication. Like I think I love podcasting, so I feel like my podcasting is almost a part of my artistic lifestyle. So I really appreciate you taking your visual art, your yogic art, your ability to write, your writing art, your blogging, and then to bring it into the conversation part. I feel like you have a good way of communicating things that are very difficult. I also really appreciate your willingness and openness to speak about some of your challenges and to also be honest that, like, I'm actually happy not practicing sometimes. Like, that's a really good one. I think that's something that we need to get out into the community a little bit too, because that whole like, ooh, bad yogi, like that's just somebody else's challenge that they have with accepting that it could potentially be okay to take a 5-day practice week versus a 6-day. Or so I feel like we're getting close to the hour that you were made so generously available to me. I don't want to hold you a whole lot longer. I really do want to continue conversing with you though, because I enjoyed it so much. Is there any other subject, topic, or thought that pops up for you that you'd like to share with us before we turn the corner toward concluding our conversation together?
Wow. First, I want to say that I'm sorry for your mom's passing.
Oh, thank you. It's a tough one. Do you still have your mom? Is your mom's?
Yeah, I have both parents, and I feel like this growing experience. I didn't say, but my eating disorder recovery journey is very generously supported with a 12-step program that is called, you know what, let's, I can say thing is about that. It's called EDA, Eating Disorders Anonymous.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I didn't know that there was a 12-step variation for eating disorder.
I think there are a few, but I find that this specific one really aligns with more softer, kinder, because it's not an abstinence-based program, because you still eat, you know, and it's not about you're a bad person if you do this. It's about learning how to be softer with yourself and also discover what are the things that are behind the habits, because it's not about food. It's never about the thing that we chose to do. It's more about what we are trying to mandate through, you know, what we are trying to cope with using the methods we use.
Yeah.
So I still go to meetings and I very slowly do the steps. It's another method, so I question it because, you know.
I need a method.
Yeah, it's a method, so I still, you know, I'm like, okay. So I do it very slowly, and I love the support of the group. I think it's one of the things that this is like a huge difference. Me 10 years ago, not willing to be a part of a group of eating disordered women, because I'm like, oh no, I don't have that, I'm totally fine. To 10 years later of like, oh my God, you know, we share the same things, you know, so it's like that openness to be with people. So because of that aspect, I also do the steps, but very slowly. So if we connect it to the parents part, I was very lucky to do the 9th step, which is making amends with my parents. And getting to that place of just really honestly, not because it's a step, not because I have to, really wanting, with getting nothing in return, to apologize to my parents for the wrongs I did. Not saying that they never did anything wrong, or that I was never hurt by them, but just to be able, truly, not because it's a yoga ideal or a forgiveness that was written in some book, but just to really go through the process of actually being super angry, blaming, hurting, depressed, and everything, and then being able to just sit there and just cry in front of them and just tell them that I'm sorry.
Wow. For what I did. That's beautiful. Yeah.
So, yes. So I'm still in contact with my parents. And I feel that the connection that I have with them, I don't know what they have with me, but how I am with them is just the best that it's ever been.
That's amazing.
In a realistic sense, not in an idealistic sense, but just in a very human, accepting, compassionate way. And I think it's because I combine all these words together and it's letting go of the ideals that I've collected, I think, that made it possible.
No, that's amazing. Doing that stuff is so important, because it's not until, if we wait to even contemplate this until after they pass. I'm so happy to hear that you've actually done that really difficult work. Maybe it wasn't so difficult, maybe it was easy, but it's pretty difficult for most of us. So that's so cool that you're on it. You're on it. Yeah, you're doing it. You're doing it. And you're ahead of the curve. Because sometimes we don't come into those sort of ideas and thoughts until we don't have the opportunity to actually know that they heard, or at least the sound vibration made it to their ears and they can decipher it how they like. But yeah, well said. Well, you know, it's funny because someone else yesterday just told me about how they went to an Al-Anon meeting, and they were just talking about how incredible the support structure of the 12-step program is. I have so many people telling me like how much benefit they get from the 12-step program, no matter which angle they're coming into it from. So I'm really glad you're bringing that up, because I'm listening. I appreciate it.
I want to say, you know, if I was, you know, I'm here and I brought up this, the EDA thing, is that I want to say that it's just no one deserves to live in this prison of eating disorders. And they come in a variety of ways. But I think it's good to give it some thought if, I don't know, if your training regime or way of eating or, I don't know, counting calories, whatever it is. And even if you don't do that, just body checking, just those little things.
Yeah.
Just see if they're really liberating for you or they are consuming you or consuming more time that you actually than you actually notice. I just want to say that, that there is help available. There is. And yeah.
Cool, Sharon. That was perfect. Thank you for adding that piece in. That's what I think is so great about conversation. And for you listening, thank you so much. And I feel like there's so much to be learned from other people's experience and journey. And it is very comforting to know when you find somebody that you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going through that too. It feels so like less isolated, more community support, which obviously we definitely can handle a little bit more of these days. In my opinion, anyway. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I think there's something about the human connection, like, but a real, true heart-to-heart connection that is
yes.
just replaceable.
Oh, man.
Priceless.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon. I'm going to continue to follow you, comment and like, and I'll share my tidbits. And I hope to have the chance to meet you in person one day, practice some yoga, and maybe even take an art class. If you ever do an art class where you incorporate online, like a yoga, like an online yoga and art workshop or something, I definitely want to do something like that. I think I could probably progress from stick figures to robot figures, like three-dimensional little cubist people.
Simpler things. Who knows? Maybe I'll get to Florida. I have some friends over there.
That would be amazing. That would be awesome. Yeah, we have such a great group here and we'd love to have you. We could host you for an art / yoga workshop. So when it's freezing cold in Germany, oh, that's coming up actually. It's going to be freezing cold in Germany very soon. Come to Florida. It already started. Come to Florida like in Jan or Feb. It's so beautiful here. It's just glorious. It's so amazing.
Sure. And it's not hurricane season. So it's like,
and it's not hurricane. Yeah, you have to not worry about it. That you can swim in the ocean. You can walk around flip flops and go swimming. No problem. In the middle of winter, you'll be warm. Like sometimes the locals will go down to the beach in the middle of winter. We'll see people swimming when we think it's cold. And we're like, oh my God, they have to either be from Michigan or they got to be from like Germany or something because they're crazy. But it's really not that cold here. So we would love to have you. And, thank you so much, Sharon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Native Yoga Toddcast is produced by myself. The theme music is dreamed up by Bryce Allen. If you like this show, let me know. If there's room for improvement, I want to hear that too. We are curious to know what you think and what you want more of. What I can improve. And if you have ideas for future guests or topics, please send us your thoughts to info@nativeyogacenter. You can find us at nativeyogacenter.com. And hey, if you did like this episode, share it with your friends, rate it and review, and join us next time.